From the land to Grand Hyatt University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 10th day of March, 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzla, GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. And we'll continue to hear excerpts as we have the last couple of days from the All Day Ag Outlook, and we'll all next week, by the way. Today, we'll hear from Eric Snodgrass at Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. He'll discuss the weather forecast for the growing regions across the planet.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, May corn for the day settled at $6.17 and a quarter, up 5 3/4. July at $6.06 and a half, 4 3/4 higher. And December new crop up 4 1/4 at $5.59 and a quarter. May beans were down 3 3/4 at $15.07. July at $14.94 and 3/4, down 4. And November beans 2 1/2 lower at $13.57 and a half. Bean meal off $1 at $4.85.90. The bean oil, $56.61, down 45 cents. Wheat futures, soft red July contract, up 13 for the harvest month at $6.90, and the hard red July at $7.89, up 20 cents on the afternoon. Live cattle futures in Chicago at $164.27 and a half, 52 and a half lower. Feeders down $1.50 at $197.65, and lean hogs at $87.45, up $2.37 and a half. Crude oil at $76.59 a barrel, up or rather 86 cents higher for the day, and the U.S. dollar on the afternoon at 104.62. That's down 0.68 for the day. Mike Zuzla, GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, now joins us. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us Tuesday, by the way, at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Hope you had a good drive home, and then, well, it's been an interesting week since then. I think we probably ought to jump straight into it. What have you found?
Well, I think the thing that we really, I feel like we've uncovered something this week, Todd, and it does go back to the Beef House meeting, and I know us old-timers call it that, so forgive me for calling it that, but I really appreciate that meeting each and every year. And as usual, you did a phenomenal job. You had great guests. I had 5 or 6 people that I work with there, and all of them called me and thanked you all and had a really nice time. But I think we've really uncovered something in the markets. We had a Thursday where the grains broke dramatically, led by the wheat once again. And you could see in terms of why the break came, it was related more to the financial markets and the overall macro markets. Not a big surprise there, but you could see that the grains and the wheat complex, specifically in corn, were being traded more as an asset versus a commodity. In other words, not really looking at supply-demand fundamentals. And then Friday came along, and you saw a very strong reversal in the wheat. March hard red wheat was able to close well above $8. May got within about a penny of its Thursday high. And so we almost had a type of reversal market in the hard red wheat. And I think we came back to trade supply demand fundamentals. So what was the common denominator there? What was the difference between those 2 days? And you can lay it directly at the feet of the U.S. bonds. They were up over 3 points, 3 percentage points, a big move for a bond market day trade. 3 percentage points on Friday versus down hard on Thursday. And those higher bond markets bring your yields down. That pushes your U.S. dollar lower. That pushes your crude oil higher. So you and I have talked a lot about what are the keys to the markets and the macro side. It's a weak dollar, strong crude oil market for a strong grain market to get the macro negativity out of the way.
And is that because the weak dollar means exports into the world market are cheaper, relatively speaking, coming out of the United States, and the price of crude oil becoming higher because it's connected now to both soybeans and corn, for sure, with ethanol, can drag both higher?
Yes, it's a healthy market because it's more inflationary. And typically when I see a weak dollar, strong crude oil market, I'll also see a strong gold and silver market, and that's your inflation gauge. And I think that is those two things, as you say, are really key and that they're both very key to the investment class. And that's why I coined the term on Thursday's blog update to clients and subscribers that grains were trading more like an asset versus a commodity, especially the corn market, given the lower expectations by the USDA, and then even further lower expectations on production by the grains exchange the following day.
What are your expectations for Monday and the rest of the week next week?
Yeah, next week it's going to be almost all about the Black Sea Grain Initiative because we are closing in on a week from that extension being done. And if it doesn't get extended, then it completely goes away and it has to be completely renegotiated from what I'm picking up. So that, and we'll continue to watch that bond market very, very closely because some of the fears in the banking industry from one of the banks becoming insolvent, first FDIC bank to become insolvent for the year 2023 happened this week.
The Russians, of course, posturing to some extent, saying that half of the last agreement was not put into place, although they didn't say exactly which half. And then, of course, we have to watch China and Russia as their relationship continues to evolve.
Yes, exactly. And that's something, you know, to go back, if you weren't at the Beef House, maybe take a look at that. We talked about that on the corn panel. And I think it's very important to start thinking about that because we could be in a new wave of deglobalization. And I think, you know, we've heard some testimony by the director of national intelligence actually talking about the same thing since that Beef House meeting. So I think it's really worth looking at and thinking about if you're in the ag sector, because ag's always in the front lines of trade negotiations between the biggest commodity importer and one of the biggest commodity exporters.
Thank you very much.
You too, Todd.
That is Mike Zuccolo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. And if you want to listen to that corn panel, it's up on the website right now at willag.org. Earlier this week, we hosted the All Day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Now, if you missed it, or if you would like to review that content, you can do it right now at willag.org. Just look for the audio files, and over the next several days, we'll be running excerpts during the closing market report. Today, we'll start with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions, who we normally talk with on Fridays anyway. He kicked off the All Day Ag Outlook on Tuesday of this week.
My goal is to not ruin the day by starting it off on a bad note. So everything I'm about to tell you, remember, it's a don't shoot the messenger kind of morning here, okay? But anyways, yeah, Todd and I were talking last week. We do this radio interview every Friday, and he says, what are you going to tell everybody, you know, when we get going? I'm like, well, just wait. We'll get there, and we'll talk about it. But I love this day, and I love what we do this time of year because we all gather and come to these meetings. You know, what are the big questions we're asking? Every time we're here, it's every panelist that's going to come up here, every speaker that's going to be in front of you, we're all going to be talking about the future, right? Future events that are going to unfold. And one of my favorite things about this time of year, February, March especially, is that the discussion is always about when was the last time we had something terrible happen? Do you notice that? Like, what is the year that everybody's comparing 2023 to right now? 2012, right? Because that was the last massive disaster. It's not to say we haven't had troubles before that, but when it was 2012, what was the year we compared 2012 to before all of the years before that? 88. What was it before that? 83 before that. 80 before that. 76 before that. The drought of the 1950s before that. The drought of the we just do that this time of year. And I know why we do this. I mean, do you understand the benefit of me coming up here and telling you all it's going to be a terrible year? Because if it's a great year, I'm like, oh, we dodged a bullet, right? If I tell you it's a great year and it's bad, you're like, you're terrible. We're never going to listen to you again and you're off, right? So I just don't do that. I'm going to tell you what I know. And I need you to know that most of what I'm going to talk about today and what the people on these panels are going to talk about, maybe everybody except for what Bob gets to talk about, is going to be very speculative. But that's what we do. We live in an industry that is based on risk assessment because nearly every decision we make is about the future. And I get it. So Todd said, what are you going to share that's going to be new and fun? Last year, we did a fun little story about the Mississippi River. I want to take you to an entirely different river this year. It's the Nile River. And I would like to share with you what I call the most famous weather forecast in human history. All right. So the time period we're going to go back to is about 3,500 years ago. And this particular forecast was made by a pharaoh. Many of you probably know the story I'm about to tell you. But there was a Pharaoh in Egypt that had a pretty terrible set of dreams, two dreams, in fact. The first dream was that there were these seven fat cows, and there were seven emaciated cows. And in his dream, the emaciated cows ate the fat cows. Woke up in a cold sweat, didn't know what was going on, fell right back asleep though moments later and had a second dream. And in that second dream, there were seven healthy stalks of grain and seven that looked terrible. And if you all remember the story, the terrible stalks of grain consumed the healthy but looked no better for it. So he wakes up a second time and he gathers all of his advisors and says, "You got to tell me what this dream meant because it felt real and I'm worried. What did it mean?" And none of his advisors could successfully interpret his dream. And one of them, I think it was his cupbearer or his baker or somebody, said, "Well, there's a guy in prison you've got downstairs who interpreted our dreams and really nailed it." And he said, "What's his name?" He said, "His name's Joseph." "Well, bring him up." So they brought up this young man named Joseph, who had a pretty sweet coat before he was thrown in jail by his brothers. Remember, they sold him into slavery, all 11 of them. And he comes upstairs and Pharaoh tells him his dream. And Joseph, without missing a beat, says, "Your dream means for the next 7 years, you're going to have incredible yields, bin busting yields. And it's going to be followed by 7 years of absolute drought and famine." And he was so convincing to Pharaoh, Pharaoh says, "What do we do?" Joseph says, "Why don't we store up 20% of the grain we have every year, just keep it in reserve so that when we go into this massive famine, it's there." And Joseph said, Pharaoh said, "Well, who are we going to put in charge of doing this?" And he looks around and he says, "Well, we're going to pick you, Joseph." And all of a sudden, this guy that was sold into slavery by his brothers becomes second in command, the prime minister for the Pharaoh. Now, the best part of the story is what happened with Joseph's brothers. Remember, Joseph's brothers were all sons of Jacob. And here they are in Canaan, and there's a famine. I'm going to tell you something. There is no other weather phenomenon that has shaped human history more than drought. Because the way that drought gets us is through things like famine or mass migration or war. And when you just think about what happened next, Joseph's dad, Jacob, says, "You need to go to Egypt. We hear they stored up grain. Take all this money, go buy it, and come back and we'll continue to live." When the brothers showed up in Egypt, Joseph recognized them, but they didn't recognize their brother. And he sends them back home, says, "Bring back my youngest brother and also bring back my father, or bring back your youngest brother and your father," which were also his, "and we'll give you even more." And what happened was, is that Jacob, who you all know was probably later named Israel, comes back to Egypt and they live. And Joseph takes care of them. They're given some of the best ground in all of Egypt on that Nile River. And over the following 400 years, they absolutely thrived and grew to a population of over 3 million people. Subsequent pharaohs, though, got a little bit upset about how well these Israelites, these descendants of Jacob, were doing. So they decided to enslave them. And that is the context of this movie I imagine a lot of you have seen called The Ten Commandments. Remember Yul Brynner and also Charlton Heston? That's the Exodus. And they tried to get back to Canaan after that, and they're kicked out of Egypt, or they tried to leave Egypt. And that basically set up, 3,500 years of strife in the Middle East, all because of a drought. Now today, you all are going to be hoping that we have Pharaoh-like dreams of what this upcoming year is going to be like. None of us dream this stuff, okay? And if we start telling you we do, you should really start asking us why we've not checked into a mental institution. Because the reality of it is that as much as I may pray and hope for one of these prophetic forecasts, God has said, not today. We're going to continue to humble you with the behavior of that atmosphere until you retire. And that's the reality of it. So I want you all to steer clear of the snake oil salesmen that are out there, because they are out there and they're going to tell you what they think. And they're always going to point toward things that don't make a lot of sense, but get you concerned and worried about the upcoming weather patterns. It's March. We haven't even got past what we call the spring barrier. In the atmosphere, there's a transition time period where it overturns in late March, April, and May. It's where the upper atmosphere stays cold, but the lower atmosphere gets really hot. And the atmosphere starts to overturn itself and creates entirely new weather events. We're witnessing that right now. And coming across the Pacific Ocean, starting in China, and no, I don't believe there's any balloons in this right now, but coming from China is this nearly straight west-east jet stream pattern. And it is on its way toward us, and it's going to hit California first. And you heard it this morning on NPR. We've been talking about it now for a couple of weeks. This is not good for California. California's been in drought for 3 years. That drought was broken from December 28th to January 17th this past year. What happened was another setup like that slammed into the West Coast. And when it did so, it delivered 32 trillion gallons of water inside of a month to California. Now, a lot of us may think that's a lot of water, but I've been telling groups all spring that that amount of water, while it seems like a ridiculous number, it only fills the Grand Canyon by about 3.5%. But still, it's a lot to bring into California, and they needed it because the reservoirs at that point in California were only at about 30% full pool. Now, California has what we call a Mediterranean climate, which means they get precipitation from October to April and then nothing for the rest of the year. And the precipitation that came in there took some of those reservoir levels, like Lake Oroville, from a level of around 600 feet to now up over 180 feet above that. That's how much the reservoirs have filled in that short amount of time. They're expected to overflow in the next week and a half. There's going to be massive flooding problems in California. Now, this water that's coming into the West right now buys them 1 year. That's it. Please don't forget that. A lot of folks will think, oh, the reservoirs are back full. They're going to be fine for the next 10 years. We will be talking about drought and fires in California by the end of this year. All right? That's just the climate out West. Don't forget that California leads the nation in the production of 40 different fruits and vegetables and milk, plus there's 40 million people out there. And what's happening right now is that the total amount of moisture that's coming into California will be equal to or more than what we saw back in early January. And the real issue right now is that the snow line is no longer down around 2,000 feet. It's expected maybe be as high as 6,000 to 8,000 feet, which means 10 to 12 inches of rain falling on 20 to 30 feet of snow. And so the flooding issues that they're going to be experiencing out there, it's all going to come into the Central Valley and try to exit into the Pacific Ocean. And we're going to be hearing a lot about major economic losses because of this. I don't know what it'll do to the farm grand out there, but it's going to be very rough go of it. Now, some of that moisture will get over the top of those mountains, and it'll eventually get over into the upper Colorado Basin, which is in Colorado. And that's going to put more snow on top of what's already been a great snow year in Colorado. And that's going to be pushing more water down the Colorado River, which will start to help fill up Lake Mead and Lake Powell. But there is not enough water in that to really fill all that up. And remember that in the Colorado Basin, the amount of water that's allotted out of that basin, is usually about 150% of what's in it, which means there's 150% of water that's spoken for that's not even there most years. And if you'd really like to read an interesting book on this, there's a great one called Where the Water Goes. A guy traces out from the upper Colorado Basin all the way down to the Baja of California and looks at the whole history of that river. And it's absolutely fascinating and extremely confusing to understand the water right policy out West. But the reality of it is that there's a lot of cold air and snowpack in the West. Now, what does all that mean for us? Well, if there's all that cold conditions out West, guess what the jet stream wants to do for all that? Go south of it. If it goes south of it, it's got to come up somewhere. Where it comes up is in the mid-Mississippi River Basin. And the overall problem with that is that a lot of people, in fact, Stu was just asking about this in the hall. If you want to get some early field work done and you want to get stuff going, maybe some early planted beans, Mother Nature is going to be providing too many weather systems in a row to kind of keep us out of the fields. But I told Stu what I'll tell all of you. I know that kind of puts a damper on what we want to get done early in the season. But at the same time, it also is recharging the soil from last fall's drought. Now, you go back to last summer and think about who got hammered with drought. There were pockets in Illinois and Indiana that got hit, especially northwestern Indiana was hit pretty hard. Some parts of central Illinois were hit pretty hard. Southern Illinois seemed to do just fine, though. But what happened last fall was that the epicenter of drought was over Oklahoma. They broke records that were set in the 1950s and the 1930s. That was during the Dust Bowl era in parts of Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas. And where that big ridge sat up last year was literally right on our doorstep. And we have to watch out any given year for where that ridge could be in the middle of summer. Now, before I come back to last summer, I do want to make one point. I told you earlier about the lack of prophetic forecasts, be it in the markets or being it with weather or anything that affects your business. But what I want you to remember is this. When anybody comes up to you and tells you that they think they know what's going to happen 6-9 months in advance, and they tell you what it is, I've told this group before, by virtue of them even talking to you about it, they're lying. Right? Let me give you the best case in point. What was the first year you all referenced that we compared drought to? 2012. Do you all remember when the market gained $3 in 2012? When did that rally start? Anybody remember? June 18th. That's when we knew there was going to be a drought. We were talking about warm March. We were talking about incredible planting conditions. In fact, you go back and survey any grower in the Midwest in 2012 and say, what did you think of the crop up and through May and even in early June? Like, oh, we were going to blow yields out of the water. Early heat, crop was out, looked fantastic. And then the atmosphere lost all of its momentum, built up into a massive ridge that set over Minnesota. Last year's ridge sat over Missouri. And the difference is, wherever the ridge is, it's literally like putting a mountain chain in the atmosphere. It blocks moisture. It gets stuck. It gets hot. And underneath that epicenter of the ridge in 2022, over the Red River Valley of the South, they had in June, July, and August over 45 days where the high temperatures above 100 degrees, humidity was at 10%, and the west winds blew dust across those areas just like they did back in the 1930s. You know what happened in 2012? That ridge was not there, but it was over Minnesota, closer to the Red River Valley of the North. And that put us firmly inside of the ridge's grip, where no big ridge-riding storms could come over the top of it and deliver the moisture to our area. So what do we think about this upcoming year? Well, one of the more important things to think about right now is that even though it's been so wet and so mild this winter, that moisture is slowly getting back into your soil. And for those of you that saw my morning report this morning, you go down into that second section and put an animation from last December's drought up until now, showing you how the soil moisture is recovering in Indiana and in Illinois down there around 40 inches. Now, that drought that got us there was one of those interesting weather events where for about 3 weeks last fall, I thought it was the best fall weather pattern you could ask for. The West got really, really hot, big ridge out there, and the flow came out of Canada for all of our fall. And flow out of Canada in fall, oh, it's dry. And I'm like, go, it's going to have wide open harvest windows. You're going to be drying everything down in the field. It's going to be amazing. And then all of a sudden, I got a phone call from my boss's boss, the head of the company. And he calls, and I've told some of you this story. He goes, Eric, what's going on with the river? And I'm like, well, what river? And that was the dumbest question I could have asked him because I know he lives in Memphis. The river is the Mississippi. Now, I live in Champaign, Illinois. The Embaraz close to me or the Boneyard Creek, this sort of dirty river that runs through campus, those are the rivers in my mind, or the Sangamon. And I'm thinking about how that gets into Illinois and so far. And he goes, Eric, the river is ridiculously low. And I immediately pulled up all the river gauge data. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's 12 feet below low stage. And he goes, we just got reports that we're going to have to stop barge traffic. And we move a lot of fertilizer up and down that river at Nutrien. And he asked me, when's that river going to recover? And I said, it took us 60 days to get here. It's probably going to take another 60 days to get out of it. Now, Stu asked me a good question about that drought. He says, what's the river traffic going to look like this upcoming spring? I got another phone call from Jeff about 2 weeks ago, saying, when is it going to stop raining on the Mid-South? Because right now, the total amount of moisture sitting over that area and what's expected to come in the next 10 days, which is 3 more inches, has got all of the tributaries feeding into the Mississippi right now in that part of the country, like Cairo, Illinois, south, in flood stage. And now we're concerned about the entire opposite part of it. And don't forget, on the northern tributaries of the Mississippi, there's up to 9 inches of liquid in the snowpack in Minnesota and in northern Wisconsin, and up there at the headwaters of the Mississippi. So Stu asked me about, are we going to see flooding out of this? I said, yeah, it's flooding already to the south. There's water to the north. We're tucked in the middle. We just got last week a tremendous amount of moisture, and all of this is just going to compound over the coming days and weeks. And you know why? Because the jet stream is nonstop from China to California. And that whole pattern is setting us up for a couple of things. It's no good for spring weather. No good for early planting. And the reason for that is that it's going to be mucky and muddy, and there's going to be river problems. But I told Stu what I'll tell all of you. I only care about it because come July, you're all going to be wanting to know where the moisture is if we do go a little drier. And if we can recharge the profile right now, that buys us a tremendous amount of time. And it's kind of interesting just to think about the assets we have in this part of the country with farming. I told some of you this story, but back in December, I was in Bozeman, Montana. It's a beautiful place. You should all go there. Absolutely amazing. It looks nothing like here. You go to Bozeman, there's 9 mountain chains that surround this city. And while I was there, I met the only corn farmer in the whole place. He grows corn to cut for silage for his cattle operation. And he comes up to me and says, Eric, what's it like farming in Illinois? I said, well, it's flat. You don't have any of this. He says, what kind of yields do people hit? I said, well, usually 200, 250 in some places. It's pretty amazing. What's your rainfall like? I'm like, well, about 40 inches. I said, what's yours? I know what his rainfall is. He's like, well, we sometimes get 8 inches in a year. And he says, well, what's your dirt like? And I'm like, well, first of all, they don't usually call it dirt where I'm from. We typically call it soil. And he says, but what's it like? And so I showed him a video that I shot in 2019 on my phone of where they were doing a saturated buffer over on the Embraer River in Vermilion County. Or no, it's Eastern Champaign County. And I showed him the video, and they had to trench down about 10 feet to lay this 12-inch piece of tile. And I'm sitting here explaining it to him. He's like, what's all that? I'm like, no, so what they're doing is blah, blah. I'm just going on and on and on. He's like, I know what pattern tile is. He says, what's all that? And he's pointing at the soil. And he asks me, where's the bedrock? And I'm like, the bedrock? I don't know, 500 feet below all of this? He goes, you dig down 12 feet and you didn't hit clay yet? I'm like, not in this guy's field. And he literally handed my phone back to me and walked off. Didn't ever want to come to Illinois to talk about it. But you see, I'm making a point here that storing that water in the soil is going to be mission critical for us going forward. The reality is over the next 7 days, we're going to be a little drier than normal here. That's not bad, but it's not going to stay that way. There's actually better forecasts that suggest that going through the middle part of March to the end of March and early April, we're going to see more wet weather than we are going to see dry weather. I don't like any of you having to mud in a crop. When the windows do open, you're going to go fast. I know you're going to go fast. You've proven that you can go fast. The most recent year where I've seen you plant at an incredible rate was in 2018. You were forced because of an incredibly cold April in 2018 to not plant a thing. And then all of a sudden, May comes along. It was the second warmest May on record. And in the first 2 weeks of May of 2018, the state average in Illinois for planting corn was 400 acres a minute. So when the windows do open, we're going to go after this very, very quickly come this spring. But there's really good news about what's going on right now in the atmosphere that's helping to recharge the soil, send that jet stream screaming from China all the way over to the United States. And that is what's prompted all of this, is that the thing that's plagued us for three straight years is finally gone. And that's La Nina. La Nina's out. It just gave up all of a sudden about 3 weeks ago. La Ninas are decided by how strong the trade winds are that run between South America and Australia. And for 3 years, it has been very strong trade winds in that area. And while that's happened, the momentum of the whole atmosphere is conserved. So if we got all this strong wind running across the equator, guess who it steals the momentum from? The jet stream where we live. Well, 3 weeks ago, all of those strong trade winds just let go. And the momentum was picked back up by the jet stream. And you're going to see it over this week screaming across the Pacific. And what that's signaling is this very rapid loss of La Nina and potentially a quick transition to El Nino. So what we're seeing right now in the atmosphere is that the jet stream is going to maintain that momentum, likely keep it through spring and through early summer. Now, what's the translation for all that? That means more routine weather systems. That means a lack of stuck weather systems. That means a lack of serious heat building in, especially when we get into summer. And on Sunday, we just had released to us the newest weather forecast model data from the Europeans. They do have a superior weather modeling system. We helped them build it. In fact, several of our top scientists were pulled away to go over there and work on these things. And it's an incredible forecasting system. They always put their new data out on a 7-month forecast on the 5th of every month. So if you do read my reports, always read the one on the morning of the 6th of every new month, because I'll include that new data. And if you saw it, what I reported yesterday on Monday, we did not see any part of the Corn Belt being forecast to be drier than normal for June, July, August. Now, do we know if that will be the case? No. This is the ECMWF, not FARO. Got it? And that model has a history of really being subjected to its own initialization, which means what it started with, it just carries. And it just got initialized with a bunch of wet weather. But it's consistent with the fact that La Nina is off the table and possibly an El Nino comes back by summer. And everybody in this room, whether you know it or not, you love El Nino, because statistically correlating El Nino against yields for corn, it's about a 5% increase over average. So more often than not, El Ninos lead to big, big yields. So that's the current setup going on right now across the Pacific Ocean that's informing these forecasts going out there for summer. In fact, I was quite surprised to see that there wasn't really a spot across the country in the longer range models that is expected to deal with exceptional heat or drought this upcoming summer right now. A year ago, that was different. When I sat up a year ago, remember why I told you about the Mississippi River? Because I said it was going to be the dividing line. East of it, better weather conditions. West of it, drier. And there was a lot of advertisement in the forecast models that that was going to be the case. And it turned out we did okay with that forecast. Most of the drought was anchored from Texas up to South Dakota and over into Western Iowa. And this year, that same model, which performed so well last year, doesn't have that. It's got rain for the Corn Belt. And the world is watching. Since I put that forecast out, I've been contacted by my friends in South America, Australia, and Europe. And all they wanted to know was, do I believe that this is going to be there? I'm like, well, you don't need to care if I believe it. It's whether or not there's any sort of evidence for it to be true. And I said, if we lose La Nina like we are, there's a pretty good chance that this is what actually manifests itself. So I'm going to go ahead and pull the gun out of my pocket and shoot my foot and tell you all right now that based on what I know on March the 7th, I do not have any reason to tell you that this upcoming summer is going to be a repeat of some of those disastrous years. There's no evidence for that. But when did the rally start in 2012? June 18th. So Todd, we need to do another one of these on June 17th, and I'll come back and tell you if I'm freaking out or if I'm happy, all right? That's the reality of this. That's when the jet stream gets bunched up and starts to cause problems that we have to be on the lookout for. All right, that's most of the U.S. Understand, remember that the U.S., we still currently have about 55% of the land area of the lower 48 in some form of drought, but you will not find that drought east of the Mississippi River. It's almost all from Texas into parts of Kansas and stretches up to North Dakota. But even the North Dakota drought on the drought monitor is not real because there's 2 feet of snow sitting on the ground there that will melt into the soil. But I'll tell you, down in Texas, I gave a talk in Texas last week. All they wanted to talk about was how long the drought was going to last. Because they have so far since the start of 2023 had 6 dust storms, the kind of which we have pictures of from the 1930s still ripping across that area. Remember that last year the cotton crop in Texas took a massive hit because they didn't plant it because how hot and dry it was. And they'd like to be in there right now planting corn, early corn. But they've had some pretty rough weather in Texas that's not allowed them to do it mainly because of drought. So you go to Kansas and start talking about these things, it's a much different situation as well. I was just in Kansas last week too, and in that group, they just wanted to know how long is this drought going to last in western Kansas. Because the last time Garden City, that's in the western side of Kansas, saw more than a half inch of liquid from the sky was July 28th last year. That's a long time without getting any moisture from the atmosphere. They don't care what it is. They bring it in as snow, bring it in as ice. I don't care. We just need the moisture. In fact, do you remember that big ice storm that hit Texas back, what was that, in early February? I think it was early to mid-February. They got an inch of ice. I got phone calls from guys in San Angelo because I asked them on email, like, how bad is it? She sent me some pictures. It says, we don't care how bad it is. That was moisture. We've got it. That's going to melt. We're going to get into our topsoil. I'm like, you just had a $1 billion ice event. And they're happy because it meant moisture coming back to that area. It's crazy to think what we're dealing with in those particular spots. Wheat, real quick before I go somewhere else in the world. The wheat crop, of course, in Kansas was hit with the pre-Christmas Arctic wave. Remember that one, the big cold outbreak before Christmas? We estimate that most of the winter wheat crop in central Kansas spent about 20 hours with temperatures below minus 18. There is another cold snap coming to Kansas, but if you saw the report this morning, I don't think the temperature will be cold enough to cause issue, but we won't really know the full damage on that crop from the big one that happened back in December until we get into April. Is the message still terrible for the drought in the West? No, there's actually some improvement in the moisture situation in the West. It's not drought curing, but it is drought improvement there. So that's what we're going to keep an eye on. Okay, why don't I go to South America next and we'll talk Europe, maybe a little Australia, and then we'll open up for questions. Are we good on time? Good, perfect. South America has been a very interesting place to forecast this year. Because depending on who you talk to, they're going to say they're having the best year ever, or they're going to having their worst year ever. I met a farmer back in early January over in Missouri. Actually, Missouri, I guess, is that way, right? And while we were there, he owns land in Cordoba. If you're interested, the I states of Argentina are called Cordoba, Buenos Aires, and Santa Fe. That's it. So he's in Cordoba. He's in a very productive area down there. And I said, how bad is it? Because my maps suggest that you're having one of the driest runs in the last 40 years. He goes, we planted some stuff early. It's done. The corn and beans he planted early were done. The wheat they took out was terrible. He goes, the stuff we planted in the middle of the season just got hit with 100-degree temperature and no precip for about 7 days. He goes, we think the yields are going to be terrible with that. He goes, when's it going to rain? I'm like, I don't think it is. Like, that was the comment that I gave the guy. So he's banking on his crops in Missouri this year to outweigh what's going on down in Argentina. because the insurance down there doesn't work the same way that works for us. So all throughout that whole area where the Paraná River flows through, the next 10 days remains very hot and very dry. And don't forget, back on February 18th, along that same river basin, there was patchy frost. So I'm not joking. They went from about a week and a half of 105 degree temperatures to patchy frost back to 105 degree temperatures. And no rain during the entire thing. You go just north of there into southern Brazil, some places in the last 40 days have had over 40 inches of rain. And it's still raining. I'm talking about Mato Grosso do Sul. I'm talking about Goiás. I'm talking about Sao Paulo getting over toward like Bahia, Minas Gerais, these areas in the eastern part as well. And that particular area, I was talking to a guy the other day, there was a weekend where in his area in Sao Paulo, they had 600 millimeters of rainfall. So in a weekend, 24 inches of rain. I said, how are the crops doing? He says, well, they're full and there's so much sand that a lot of this water drains away. He goes, but it's still not good. And I've seen videos of fish swimming in soybean fields lately. Now you go north of there and it'll be hard pressed to find somebody in Mato Grosso that doesn't have a big smile on their face. Mato Grosso is the biggest producing area. It's got about 35% of all the crops grown in Brazil. And Mato Grosso is, you can put Texas all the way on the inside of it and have a lot of leftover room. I think you can put 9 Indianas inside of Mato Grosso. That's how big it is. They were a little bit late getting the crop out. First one, nobody cared because that crop was huge. And they were a little bit late putting in safrina. And now it's raining on that safrina crop and everybody's happy. And it's one of those things like when the ice states hit, plus if you get a little bit of Minnesota, some of Nebraska, that it doesn't matter what all the other states that grow corn in the United States do. It's kind of like that with Mato Grosso. And some of the numbers you've heard, I'm sure numbers will be discussed later on today by the panelists, but given the fact that the NDVI values, that's satellite measured vegetation health, for most of Brazil is the highest it's been in 20 years, some of these numbers you hear that are between 153 and 158 million metric ton on beans, they're real, but the only issue is, can they get the crop out in southern Brazil? Is it going to dry down enough for that? So, safrina crop, is there any chance that the monsoon lets out early? The monsoonal flow typically goes all the way through the beginning of April and starts to slow down toward the end of April. And when they're trying to get that crop to finish in middle of May, usually the monsoon is done. Some years it backs off early, and there's always concern that that could happen. I have no evidence right now to tell you that it's going to back off early. So that's the story coming out of South America. Europe, Western Europe's been in drought this entire winter. And the snowpack in the Alps and other surrounding mountain chains has been terrible. I've been joking. I said, usually when the skiers are mad in winter, the farmers are mad in summer. But the same atmospheric river that's coming toward California has kind of a mirroring effect in the Atlantic and sending moisture to parts of France, the Iberian Peninsula, which is where Spain and Portugal are, and into the British Isles and Western Germany. This could be absolutely critical rainfall for them over the next 10 days. So we're going to watch that carefully. You ask about the Black Sea. Black Sea has honestly been a bit of a mystery to me this winter. They have had a pretty wild ride on it in terms of temperatures. We go into the spring. There are some patchy regions of drought in the Black Sea and parts of Ukraine and the Russian wheat belt. But there's no strong long-term indicators that the Black Sea is going to have a rough spring or upcoming growing season. So the biggest unknown there just remains to be the war. You keep going across Asia. They are right now in parts of China and Russia having one of their hottest winters going into spring on record. One of my favorite cities in the whole world, the forecast is this place called Yakutsk. It's in Siberia. And up there, an average midwinter high temperature is minus 45 Fahrenheit. Average. Right now, the temperatures are minus 15. And that's like shorts and t-shirt weather for some of those people. It's incredible how mild it is. We have concerns about China in the upcoming season because of drought. This transition away from La Nina, it sometimes means the Manchurian Plain and the North China Plain, that's where they grow a lot of their corn and beans, could see dry conditions going forward. We'll never know, other than our observations, if it's a problem, because what gets reported is never kind of what's truly happening there. So we'll just have to wait and see. And last couple of places to take you around the world, Australia. I just got an invitation last week for a 2-year stay in Australia. I turned it down immediately. You know why? I would have gone 3 years ago when La Nina started. Australians love La Nina. Lots of rain. but they're about to begin an El Nino. And that's when they decide to invite me. When I go down and talk to every grower about 3 years of drought in Australia. So I reported back this morning, no, thank you. I'm overcommitted was my line. I should have said, no, thank you. El Nino's coming and I'll get shot if I go down there and tell everybody about it. But that's going to be a very interesting area to watch in the coming months. We do have some crops that we're in competition with down there, but they do grow a lot of winter crops in Australia. Okay, off the top of my head, that should hit the whole planet. Hopefully you've come up with some good questions for me. So Todd, let's turn it over and get those questions. Good question. Have we ever had a drought during an El Nino? We have had drought during transition years away from El Nino. In fact, now remember, this is not an analog year, but 2012 was a transition year. Thinking back on it, I tell you what, because I can't think of a year off the top of my head where there was a strong El Nino signal and drought, when I do my video content later this week for my reports, I'll look into that and report on it because I can't think of one. That doesn't mean we don't have regional drought, you know, some areas, but big wide-scale drought, I can't think of a year.
1991.
Yeah. And 1991 is actually in my ensemble package of worst years for the Midwest. But was there an El Nino that year? I have to go back and look. That's a great question.
Other questions? Right over here. Yes, sir. How will the weather affect Ukraine this spring?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I can tell you what the models are showing. They've got actually a little bit of a drier bias in Ukraine. But I don't think Ukraine came out of winter with major soil moisture problems. So that may not be a bad thing. You could look at seven different models from seven different forecasting agencies and get seven different results for the Black Sea area. So I can't even comment on what I think it's going to be, nor do we really have an estimate on what will get planted this upcoming year. That is going to continue to be a major source of uncertainty until the conflict with Russia is over.
Yes, sir. When will the U.S. weather model catch up with the European? I feel like Karnak when I repeat.
Do you know the problem with why there's not major investment in this? Is because most of you are satisfied with our performance with weather forecasting. Now, what I mean by that is every one of you has in your pocket or in your purse or in a bag a phone that you can open up at any given time, and it gives you a decent enough forecast that you can make a decision off of it. So because you're not complaining, the government is not flooding money into NOAA and the National Weather Service to improve their infrastructure. Now, one of the great things that Trump did do was actually increase funding for NOAA's computing infrastructure. And that's good. And our models are improving dramatically with time. And if you ask how much better are the Europeans than us, it's normally between 1% and 3%. But that makes a big difference at certain times of the year. And why the European model is so much better is this. This is the main reason, okay? Every morning, when we run it four times a day, but every time the model is initialized and starts to process your future weather, it has to take in a snapshot of what's going on right now. That's what we call the initial condition. And then it predicts going forward. It takes time for the computer to make all those predictions. Back in the 1980s, it would take 24 hours to do a 24-hour forecast. So that's why we were so terrible in the 1980s at forecasting your weather. But now in about 3 hours, it'll forecast out 10 days. So when we start that model, what the European model does is over those 3 hours, it is constantly taking in everything that changed from when it started and over those next 3 hours to account for the missed variability in the initial conditions. The US model has not adopted that technique yet. It's computationally expensive. We are the first to publish how to do that, though. So they used it. It's fine. That's the scientific community. But that's what's going on there. By the way, that model costs me $250,000 a year to show you every morning. The Europeans model is owned by 28 nation states, and they charge to use it. But we want to show it so you can compare things to it. It's a good question.
And he comes to you for free on Friday after. That's right. What a bargain that is.
The airwaves.
Other questions?
I think there's one in the back. Yeah.
Yes.
Weather app. Which weather app would I recommend?
Yes.
You know, so let me be honest with you. The weather app situation. I do have some on my phone that I really like. I like Weather Underground. It was the first. And Weather Underground built its own API. They sold it to IBM. And it's a great database on which they build their forecasts. It's not perfect. Everything that you get on a weather app has never passed over human eyes. It is literally processed statistically and sent out because the weather app is the most viewed app on anyone's phone by far. And so to be able to manage the multi-billion number of hits that it gets every single day, there's no human forecast intervention with it. The most prolific API that powers all of your apps was just sold to Apple, and they took it all off the market. That was called the Dark Sky API. You can use the one I'm building. It's only a web application right now. But it will soon, over the next 6 months, that's the plan, that's what Nutrients told me, be into a fully mobile app. And what I'll give you in that app is what you can already see on the web, is I'm not going to take all of the numbers and try to distill them down and give you an average. I'm actually going to show you them all. If you'd like to know what the five main models we use are, here's all of their numbers. Because what I found with all of you is you tend to build trust in one or two of them, and you like to look at them. So we put it all up there. Plus the app that we're building is going to have full history of weather data as well, back 40 years. So you can do comparisons in the past. Right now, all of that lives on a website I built called agweather.com. That's ag-wx.com, ag-wx.com. So you can't really pull it up on your phone, but you can get point forecasts for 30,000 locations in the US. That's my test bed. And also see every weather map that I use every day. Now, just a bit of understanding. I built this site. I am not a UX person. I'm not a front-end designer. I'm a nerd. So it'll be revamped by someone that's a professional at doing this very soon. But it's there and it's free and it's available. ag-wx.com. WX is, I use that because that is the Morse code for weather. So kind of fun little history there.
Any final question? When do you see us having a good opportunity for spring planting?
After April 5th. Sure. No. To be honest, that is never a question we can answer more than 7 to 10 days in advance. Because what determines your windows are frost threat. What determines those windows are the timing of rainfall events and your current soil moisture. And so one of the things that I do put in that app, the web application, is you can always go down and look at your current soil moisture plus your 10-day forecast of it. And also look at your soil temperatures. I include in my forecast of temperature, I always put a frost zone in there. Like, hey, you're getting close to 36 or cooler. There's going to be some patchy frost issues. And once you finally see the forecast pushing your soil temps above 50, then it's going to be just looking for rainfall events. And that is, you do realize that you all live in a part of the world that has the largest variety of weather systems than anywhere. At any given time, right here, there can be six different air masses that occupy this area. Yesterday, you know where that air mass came from? The Caribbean. Remember how beautiful it was? It's been replaced. You know what's coming later this week? Air that started over Siberia. It's going to meet air that came from China. And maybe there's a little bit of moisture in it from the Gulf of Mexico, which is why south of here, I'm expecting severe storms in the mid-south. And that completely just upsets the ability to predict more than 7 to 10 days in advance for what we think will happen on your field, on your farm. So I can't tell you when the windows are going to open up with any sort of accuracy. There are almost always windows. And even in 2019, when was your best crop planted in 2019? You know, some in late May, some in June. So it's amazing how sometimes we can still find late windows. Because you live in a part of the country where before we get into our last frost, we have almost always accumulated at least 3,000 GDDs. So we have a beautiful place here in which to grow these crops. But I can't tell you exactly now. That's a good question.
Is there a reason? Is it just the size of the Midwest or the United States that causes that many things to be happening at once? Or is it because of the geography of the United States?
Why you have that weather is because over to our west, there's a massive chain of mountains that sticks up 14 to 20,000 feet. And the jet stream comes from China and hits that and gets disrupted. Spins up brand new weather systems that draw on moisture from the Gulf. And this is the other part of the geography. There's no mountain chain between us and the Gulf of Mexico. You look anywhere else on the planet, they have east-west running mountain chains. not in North and South America. They run north-south, and that invigorates new systems and allows moisture and heat to come up from the equator, both north or south, depending on where you are in each hemisphere, and that's what gives us the variety of weather we have. Why is the middle of China a massive desert? Because the Himalayas stops it all. What are our Himalayas? We call them the Ozarks, and they don't compare. Those are like little tiny bumps in the road to the flow coming up in this part of the country. That's a good question, Ty.
I might have known the answer.
Oh. Have we talked about that?
My wife tells me all the time that I have an enormous number of useless ag facts, and that might be one of them.
Yeah.
But give him a nice thank you. I appreciate it. So I do have one other question. So Eric and I talk at about 11:30, 11:45 on Friday mornings, and we usually start our conversation with what?
With what we're reading.
That's right. But we're not what we're reading. People get mad at us, but what we're listening to.
Yeah. We're on the road a lot. In fact, I'm going from here to Indy and then to Orlando for the Commodity Classic. So I've got my book already going.
What are you doing?
I'm reading Aviators. Have you guys read this one? It's about Rickenbacker, Lindbergh, and
I haven't started it yet. I will next. It will this week.
People that made flying what it, I love World War I, World War II stuff.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing book. Highly recommend it. I'm also reading a book about a new book on geography. The previous one was called Prisoners of Geography. This one, I forget what it's called, but it's amazing. And if you can't tell, I'm actually going to make the whole year to read the entire Bible. That's where I got my story about the Pharaoh. I just finished Levitical Law. I'm never going to read that again. So that was done. But I've always wanted to read that thing front to back. And so there you go.
Yeah. So next on my list is The Aviators.
Yeah.
I'll read that, listen to that while I'm driving and or while I'm walking. And I just finished up Pastures of Heaven. I really like Steinbeck. It is a series of, it took me a second because he writes novels that are long, and I think it's 11 hours long, and I want to say there are 11 short stories all set in the same place. And about the third short story, I was thinking, because they're all related, but they're all different. And it took me a bit to get to it, so it's always fun. Thank you for filling me in on what we should listen to and for the weather, too. That was Eric Snodgrass from earlier in the week. He made a presentation at the All Day Agricultural Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Our thanks to Eric and all the rest of the crew that made presentations that day. In fact, if you'd like to review them, they're up on our website right now at willag.org, willag.org. There are 10 presentations there, and we'll hear more of them next week as I'll be out of the office right here during the closing market report. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.